The 4th District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Craig H.D. Armon presiding.
Morning, counsel. We'll call case number 4-22-0924, June Brunton versus Robert Krueger et al. Could counsel for the appellant please state your name for the record?
Your Honor, Mercer Turner from Bloomington, Illinois.
Thank you. And counsel for the appellee, could you please state your name for the record?
Justin Karubis, on behalf of the appellees, I will be arguing the appeal today, and I'm joined by my co-counsel, Daryl Dyes.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Turner, you may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel, the argument that the appellant has is about a legal decision, a decision of law made at the lower court regarding the presumption of undue influence. We believe that this should be reviewed as a mistake of law. It's very similar to, it's analogous to the mistake of law that occurred in the Hoover decision, which the Hoover decision I'm referring to is the Supreme Court decision, which the Supreme Court said in a Supreme Court decision after this case was filed was the leading undue influence case in Illinois. In the Hoover decision, the circuit court had entered a sanction against the some of the parties that had contested the will, because the circuit court thought it was inappropriate to bring an undue influence claim. At the same time, the testator had capacity. And
Mr. Turner, good morning. May I ask a question, please?
You bet.
You suggest that the trial court erred in refusing to find a presumption of undue influence in this case. But if you can tell us, what evidence was there of any direct connection between the accountant, Mr. Streichel, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, and Robert Krueger in procurement of these new wills in 2005?
There is none.
All right. So then what authority do you have to share with us where an accountant who does not benefit from this testamentary plan and with no connection to the beneficiaries can serve as a basis for an undue influence claim?
We cited maybe a dozen decisions in our briefing. And in those decisions, the proposition is recited that the legal principle is contained that it makes no difference who commits the undue influence. If there is undue influence, which is occurs, it's presumed to be influence made by the beneficiaries that benefited from the undue influence. But that's, quite frankly, somewhat of a superficial analysis of that concept. And the reason is the way it's imputed is in the remedy. Once undue influence is found, the remedy is the nullification of the testamentary instrument. And in this case, the fact that Mr. Strigel was involved in having the petitioner removed as a beneficiary and having a non-existent put agreement be substituted in lieu of the benefit they were planning on giving her in the testamentary or in the trust, the living trust, you know, that action is not disputed, and that is part of and a good portion of the act of undue influence.
Well, let's look at that put agreement for a second. Under the agreement, she would receive $500,000, correct?
Well, the put agreement.
It's actually a simple question. If I'm mistaken,
the answer to that is no. That's not correct, Your Honor. And I'm sorry to have to say that.
No, that's fine. I that's why I broke in and said if I'm not assessing it correctly, then please correct me. Under the put agreement, what was she to receive?
Well, the put agreement would be activated at the passing of both of her parents, and then the way a put agreement works is she would tender her shares of stock in the company for purchase, and in return there would have been a long-term payment of principal and interest to her over her lifetime, and her lifetime would have been calculated based upon her age at the time.
And there was no reference to $500,000 as the amount to be paid for the stock, which would then be paid out to her over her lifetime, which, I mean, she was 60 at the time, so the next 20 years or so.
There was a financial analysis made in a letter by Mr. Striegel that indicated what the total value of the company would have been, what her percentage of ownership would have been, and that would be used.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. And perhaps that's what you're referring to, is that letter, which estimated what would be available for paying a lifetime annuity to her.
Okay. So instead, they went out, got a loan, and paid her $961,000 in a flat sum, correct?
Well, that occurred some years later.
Because nobody was dead at the time the agreement was entered.
Well, yes, but also over that period of time, the value of the underlying assets also materially increased. So to say, or to think that, well, she made a profit in this transaction isn't an accurate analysis, because the value of the underlying asset would have increased in value more than the difference between $500,000 and $900,000.
Well, was there any evidence that she was forced to sell her stock for the $961,000?
The evidence was that the primary beneficiary that benefited from the undue influence, Robert Krueger, was the person that made the purchase. That's what the evidence was.
Sure. But that begs the question, was there any evidence that she was forced to sell her stock for $961,000?
Well, in undue influence cases, there isn't force asserted against the beneficiary. That would not be a relevant inquiry. What would be irrelevant?
I feel like I'm talking to the president's press secretary. The question is very simple. Is there any evidence that she was forced to sell her stock for $961,000? That's no. Really a question that can be answered yes or no.
And the answer is no, there is no evidence.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
I have another.
Please, listen, I'm very interested in answering all your questions, so please don't ask them. Okay, I'm ready. Go.
Justice Zinoff has been experiencing some internet problems.
Sir.
Looks like they may have started up again.
With respect to undue influence, and I apologize. All right, well, if you can't, well, let me see if I can get the question out. If not, I apologize.
I'm hearing now.
For an undue influence presumption, there are four elements. How do we look at and meet this fourth element that the will was prepared by or procured by the beneficiary? What evidence is there that Robert was involved in procuring this new will?
There is none. It's presumed.
It's presumed because? Mm-hmm. Because
the law provides, and long settled law provides, that when undue influence occurs, it's attributed to the beneficiaries that benefited from the undue influence.
You, counsel, I'm just going to jump in because I've been listening, and what I'm picking up on is it seems that you are relying on putting this undue influence together, this argument by wholly circumstantial evidence. But if you get down to just what undue influence is, there's got to be a direct connection to the execution of the document. Where is that? Because you are arguing this as though there was undue influence. Where's the direct connection at the time of the execution of the document where the influence, undue influence was applied?
If the law provides that a third party can commit undue influence without evidence of connection to the primary beneficiaries.
What case do you have that says that? You keep saying that procurement is not an issue because the third party is the procurer. But other than one line out of Cheney, completely out of context in relation to this case, you don't cite any authority for that principle.
There's a whole line of cases. Now, they don't follow each other.
Well, you say that, but the trial judge said, you know, I looked at all those cases, and in every one of those cases, there was some direct connection to be found. I think the court's language, in fact, was that in no instance where third-party conduct was imputed to a beneficiary was there no evidence of a direct connection. Rather, there was evidence of an intention to benefit the beneficiaries, or there was evidence that the beneficiaries were seeking the help of the third party, which gets me back to Justice Kavanaugh's question. What evidence do you have that Mr. Striegel or any of the beneficiaries somehow were connected, involved, or directly related in procuring these terms?
None. No, there is none.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. I think the line of cases has been settled. The law is settled that there can be third party undue influence. The idea that, well, where is a case involving a CPA? When several of these cases were decided, the occupation of CPA didn't exist. I think the most analogous circumstance would be, an attorney. Mr. Striegel was providing some services that are related to the similar to the type of services an attorney would provide in estate planning. And I don't think there's any question that the law recognizes that an attorney can be involved in the commission of undue influence. Now,
but you didn't say Mr. Barger did anything.
Well, Mr. Barger didn't review with the testators the change made by Mr. Striegel, which was to remove the petitioner as a beneficiary of the trust.
He didn't review it. What are you talking about? There's a whole series of correspondence back and forth with the terms that are being discussed between Mr. Striegel, between the decedents, and between the attorney. And in fact, he sends back letters saying, no, they don't like this provision. In fact, they don't want to give her the $500,000. They were not in agreement to give her $500,000.
That was Mr. Striegel's letter. That wasn't a letter from Helen and Gordon Krueger. And the evidence is, and it's undisputed, that there was no communication between Mr. Barger and Helen and Gordon after June of 2005, except for a single letter that was sent to them in November, which contained the final draft of the wills and trust. And the evidence shows there were no questions in response to that letter. And then the meeting on December 7th to have it signed, at which time Mr. Striegel was present and served as a witness of the wills.
So what is it you're saying he did? And what is you? What are you basing that on?
That's my question as well. I was about to ask the same question.
What he did was he had them remove.
How did he do that?
By proposing.
What evidence is there that he proposed any specific terms other than those that related to trying to save them some taxes?
It is in an August 12th letter, which is attached to the reply brief from Mr. Striegel, where he specifically makes that proposal, and in Mr. Barger's testimony saying that he followed that August 12th letter in making changes to the documents to conform to that letter, and without reviewing it with Helen and Gordon or discussing it with them specifically.
So that's it?
That's it.
Okay.
And what changes are you referring to? I mean, weren't the relative positions of the siblings vis-a-vis the shares the same in the 1992 wills as the 2005 wills? At least Robert got the most, June got the least.
Yes. In terms of relative percentages, you could make that conclusion. Yes. But there was material increase in the benefit to Robert. And dollars used.
Okay, so what actually was done?
The shares of stock of the farm corporation, K Farms Inc., was all allocated to Robert. And in the earlier document, it was divided among the four children, with the petitioner receiving the smallest percentage. And in the brief, we line out the amount of what my client would have received. In terms of the dollars that were used by Mr. Striegel to value the assets in 2005, when the wills and trusts were made, my client had her benefit reduced by something like $1.5 million.
Well, if they didn't want to give her $500,000, it's probably reasonable to assume they didn't want to give her $1.5 million, isn't it?
The position that we have in this is that they indeed wanted to give her $500,000. And the reason they didn't give her that or more was because Mr. Striegel suggested they leave her a put agreement.
But so instead of the $500,000, she got $961,000.
No, that's not an accurate.
She didn't get $961,000.
She did. Okay. She sold her stock to Robert for that amount. But it didn't have anything to do with the signing of the 2005 wills. And if it did, Robert was the person doing it. He was, you know, that would.
What was the evidence that Robert was involved in procuring anything?
Well, he procured that purchase, and there's direct evidence in the testimony.
Well, no, actually, he didn't. He wasn't the one that went to the bank and got the money initially. He's the one who actually made the purchase, but he didn't negotiate the loan, did he?
There is evidence that he's the one that arranged for the loan. The discussions that they had, that the loan officer had with Gordon, was preliminary in nature. It was finished by Robert, and the evidence is clear about that in the testimony.
And the evidence is equally clear that Gordon said this was for an inheritance for his daughter.
Yes.
Okay. You understand, Mr. Turner, our difficulty in that it seems like you are trying to put together a principle of law from a thread from one line of cases and a thread from another without any authority whatsoever for the ultimate principle that you're putting forth. That procurement, I think your terminology is, procurement is not an issue because the third party is the procurer, and that's pretty much the principle that you set out, but yet there aren't any cases that say that by itself, where there isn't a direct connection between the person procuring the benefit, procuring the will, and receiving a benefit of some sort, or being involved in or connected to someone who's receiving a benefit. And here all we've got is an accountant who apparently receives no benefit of any kind, a lawyer who receives no benefit of any kind, and Robert, who wasn't involved in any in negotiating or creating, instructing, or suggesting any of the terms.
If I could respond, please, I'll be very brief. If you require that there be evidence connecting the person who's charged with committing the undue influence with the principal beneficiaries, if you require that connection, you essentially eliminate the legal concept of presumption of undue influence, because there's, you're saying you can't presume anything. You have to have direct proof on every detail that leads from A to Z. And I don't believe that's what the law says. I believe the law is settled. And the connection that you're saying needs to be there, I understand what you're telling me. And I'm trying to be polite and saying I disagree with you.
I understand that, and that's fine. Okay. You're more than entitled to disagree.
Okay. I believe the law says that you can use a presumption when there has been undue influence, and that the innocence of the beneficiaries is irrelevant. And there's case laws that say that, and I've cited it and quoted it in the brief.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Turner. You will have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Karubas.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. The trial court did not exclude evidence imputing Mr. Striegel's conduct to the beneficiary, Robert Krueger.
Mr. Karubas, can I just interrupt just for this one quick question?
Yeah.
You close out your brief with a jurisdictional question, kind of like a throwaway, and jurisdiction would kind of be rather essential to even addressing any of the other issues. So I'm wondering, are you just giving up on that issue completely, or did you just include that for the heck of it?
Well, I wanted to apprise the court of a potential jurisdictional issue. I had, 12 different arguments to make, and I picked my most important one first. But jurisdictional is definitely an issue here. I could delve into that.
If there's a lack of jurisdiction, then we're done.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why don't we talk about that?
Okay. I mean, the court has a basis to deny jurisdiction. There's two ways that I raised up: the pending counterclaims or the untimely post-trial motions.
Was it untimely if the judge then provided a supplemental decision which superseded the previous?
And I was unable to find any case law that said they could go back and make it timely by redoing the judgment time. So that's why I kind of threw it on the court and said, these were the facts. This is how it went down. The post-trial motion was late, but then the judgment got amended back. So, I don't know if that corrects your jurisdiction, our jurisdictional issue.
All right, go ahead with your substantive issues then.
And I recognize that this case is 12 years old, so jump in if there's any questions as they come up. It's not a deficiency in the trial court in excluding some evidence. It was the deficiency in the petitioner in providing the court with sufficient evidence to be able to impute Mr. Striegel's conduct to the beneficiary, Robert Krueger, for the purposes of the presumption. One of the issues I think we all wrestle with when discussing undue influence is undue influence can be proved by specific conduct, regardless of the presumption. And if there is specific conduct of undue influence, then the innocence of the beneficiary doesn't matter. Then there, you don't have to have a connection because there's specific conduct of undue influence that overcomes the will of the testator in making the wills and trusts. What differs from our case here is petitioners relying on the presumption. And the presumption has those four prongs that need to be met. And by simply following the jury instructions, the procurement prong talks about the beneficiary having to prepare the will. Well, that's too easy. We don't go into the beneficiary preparing the will. So the beneficiary has to cause the preparation of the will. Now, there's a number of cases that deal with defining this cause, the preparation of the will, nexus, connection. So it tries to flesh some of those out. Is there some kind of active participation in the procurement? That was the Cheney versus Gold case. Is the beneficiary a go-between or an agent? So the beneficiary asks a third party. In this case, hypothetically, if Robert Krueger told the accountant to go change my dad's will, that would be evidence of causing the procurement. There was none of that in this case, but that is causing the procurement. That was evidenced in the Smith versus Henline case. So the procurement prong has been defined over the years, and there's not that many cases. We're talking 5-6 cases over 100 years as we try to flush out what is the causing procurement for the purposes of the presumption only. Another one was the Schmidt versus Schmier case, which dealt with the close relationship. The beneficiary was the wife, the husband was the procurer. The court said, that's close enough. There's some benefit there. We're going to find that there's enough for presumption. So the law requires a link, whether you call it a connection, a nexus, for the presumption to exist. The petitioner failed to provide enough evidence for that presumption, and the petitioner wants the court to provide that link. The court failed to impute. That's not the case. There was not sufficient evidence for the court to find that there was enough of a link. And that doesn't even go into the rebuttal argument. So even if there is a presumption, the court then found that, assuming there is a presumption, there's been plenty of evidence that that presumption would have been rebutted by clear and convincing evidence. Robert wasn't involved. Robert was involved in K Farms. He was the farmer. His wife was involved in K Farms Farms. His kids were involved in K Farms Farms.
Counsel, my question to you is, did it not matter that these new documents created a $9 million increase in testamentary benefit for Robert? Isn't that important here when we look at this issue?
Yes, it is.
All right. And how do you suggest we fit that into looking at whether there was undue influence or not?
Well, that goes into testamentary freedom. In my view, you are allowed to do with your money with what you want. The question is somebody forcing you to do what you want with your money? And so I can give my $9 million to any one of my kids. Is any one of my kids making me do that? So I would go into, that's what Gordon and Helen Krueger wanted to do. Now, were any of the kids party or involved in making Gordon and Helen do that? And the answer is no. There's no evidence that there was any involvement. Does that sufficiently answer your question?
Yes.
And then continuing on the rebuttal argument, June Brunton's participation in the family. There was a family dynamic over the years, evidence of not being present in Gordon and Helen's life. You can tell by some close friends of Helen Krueger not seeing June Brunton around, June Brunton not being present at the funeral. You could tell that there was a family dynamic going on. I don't, you know, it's hard to get that with specificity, but there are certain examples you get that say that out of all the kids, some were around, some weren't. That might decide what a testator wants to do with their money based on who was present. And the estate planning process was normal. We had Mr. Fleming, we had two attorneys and an accountant over 6 months, write a bunch of letters, have an initial meeting. Gordon and Helen Kruger let the accountant and the attorneys have back and forth to figure out exactly what the terms were. But they retained their desire on where the money goes. That's what clients are concerned about. You know, who's in charge and who gets the money? That's what they were focused on. Let the accountant save me money. Let the attorneys figure out how to go about doing it. You know, they met in June, they met in December. It was a normal process. None of the children were involved in this process. Three professionals. It wasn't a rushed process. Nobody was at the death's door. We have only one living eyewitness, Mr. Barger, the drafting attorney. And he says it was Gordon and Helen Kruger's intention to exclude June Brunton. That's telling evidence right there. We also had a geriatric psychiatrist testify that Gordon and Helen were not vulnerable to undue influence. And an attorney testified that there was no undue influence. This is all in effort of rebutting whatever presumption might have been there. So even if there was a presumption, even if there was some procurement based on trying to cobble it together, there's a mountain of evidence on the other side to say that that presumption is rebutted.
Counsel, is there evidence that the accountant, Striegel, hid appellant's disinheritance by structuring this put agreement that never materialized? The put agreement that should have had income for life for her?
No, there's no evidence that it was hidden. There was evidence that there was a draft done by an attorney and some discussions in the letters, but we don't have any testimony from Striegel or Gordon and Helen Kruger about it. So there's no evidence that it was hidden or disclosed, or anybody refused to sign or didn't sign, or why they didn't sign. We just have a draft of a document that was prepared and ultimately not signed. I have no further arguments, unless you wanted me to delve into some other areas. The standard of review is another area I think that I was wrestling with. I leaned on the Kaufman case, which has not been further published as of yesterday, to say that the standard review is de novo. If we are just wrestling with the whether or not there was a presumption question, and then the standard of review is the manifest weight of evidence, if we are discussing whether the evidence of rebuttal is enough to rebut the presumption. So, unless further questions, I have nothing further to argue. I ask that you deny the appeal. Thank you.
I see no other questions. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Turner, rebuttal.
In rebuttal, Your Honor, I would say a couple of straightforward arguments. First, if the court is going to require that there be evidence connecting the party guilty of the undue influence with the primary beneficiary, then that will essentially eviscerate the long-held settled law of imputing undue influence committed by third parties.
Well, in each of the cases that you cite, Mr. Turner, the third parties involved have some connection, either a marital relationship or they had a benefit that they were going to receive themselves, or that they were actively involved in the procurement. So I'm trying to figure out where you come up with the conclusion that you don't need any evidence of any connection whatsoever. Because that long line of cases you talk about, which is only actually about four.
Okay. Five, well, the cases.
There's always a connection.
Well, you're reading into the cases that there is a connection, a factual connection from the statement of facts in the case or analyzing who are the principals or the human beings involved in the case. But none of those cases,
that's kind of how we do it.
I know it, but none of those cases say that there has to be proof of a conspiracy between the party committing undue influence and the beneficiaries. So I'd like to make one more quick argument, just a very quick one. And the reason that I believe that I'm correct on the law on this, and I say so respectfully, I respect your argument, a will contest is an interim action. Nobody is finding anyone guilty or liable, or there's not a judgment entered against anybody. It's an interim action. It has to do with the documents. Thank you, Judge. That's all I have in rebuttal, but I'm pleased to answer any more questions. I guess I do have one more thing before I shut myself off. If I can have one more minute.
No, go right ahead.
In terms of the jurisdiction, there was an immediate post-trial motion filed by the respondents, and that issue still pends, and the trial court was having difficulty resolving it. That's why this appeal came the way it did, without all the issues being resolved, and it's pending from the end of the trial, and it still pends today. While that is pending, the court is entitled to allow us to file a post-trial motion, regardless of when it occurs. That's all I have to say about this. So jurisdiction is not an issue.
Two quick questions. One, it was interesting that the motion that's at the crux of this entire case is the one document that doesn't appear in the record. How did that happen? Anybody have any idea?
The petitioner's motion to find presumption, is that what you're referring to? Yes. Correct. That would have been just an oversight on my part. There were a number of motions that were filed, prepared and filed after the trial commenced. And I filed proof that it got circulated to everybody and got argued. But the next step of getting it into the file, that would have been my fault for not putting it there.
Okay, I couldn't figure out, because there's a written response. So obviously there was a written pleading out there somewhere and the judge referenced it. So obviously it was there, but somehow it wasn't in the record. And that was a question of mine. That's really the only question I have. Any other questions? All right.
Thank you,
counsel. We appreciate your argument.
Thank you.
Take this matter under advisement. The court stands in recess.